Not too long ago, Dylan Mortimer was walking the floors of a St. Louis hospital attached to an oxygen tank. Dylan's an artist and a pastor, and he has cystic fibrosis. That's a genetic disease that causes a really thick mucus to build up in someone's lungs. It's hard. Actually, it's almost impossible to breathe. Dylan's been dealing with this disease since he was diagnosed as a baby, but he didn't deal with it in his art until a few years ago. In one of the first images he created about cystic fibrosis, you see what looks like a tree in a science fiction fantasy. It's got pink branches dripping with bright green sap. But it's not really a tree. The branches are veins surrounded by lungs. And that green sap is mucus. It's a portrait of the artist inside out. From a dot in the middle of the map, this is Midwesternish. I'm Gina Kaufman. In this episode, Dylan Mortimer talks about art, religion, and a daunting diagnosis. Oh yeah, and Air Jordans. We'll explain that later. The piece I described before, Airway Clearance, is really, really beautiful, even though what it depicts is pretty gross. I mean, it's the evacuation of mucus from the lungs. Is that something you have to go through?
Yeah, that treatment I do really about once a day. you lay down or upside down if possible, and have someone clap on your lungs to try to shake the gook out. Yeah, it's an intense process. It's not comfortable. I always feel better after, you know, feel a little more clear in my lungs afterwards. But yeah, I wouldn't say it's fun. So.
Your art, though, does give it kind of this magical, enticing sheen in a way, with a hint of something ominous that I think mostly has to do with the green dripping ooze. But the overall picture is really magical, enticing at the same time.
The story of my life really is trying to, you know, what do you do with such a severe diagnosis? What do you do when at 3 months before I can even remember, I'm given this heavy chronic diagnosis, and my whole life has been about trying to reverse that diagnosis and trying to find joy, beauty, sparkle in the midst of pain and suffering, you know. And there's a lot of pain and suffering, but you know, I hope that people can resonate in their own journeys and their own pain and suffering, that, you know, sometimes in those moments is when we find beauty and sparkle and joy and things like that. So yeah, that's been the journey.
You're 36, and I mean, at least how I've always kind of understood it, people don't generally expect children with cystic fibrosis to live even to be the age that you are now. I mean, did you understand that growing up?
I did. You know, I had hope that I would live beyond. I mean, certainly I would hear statistics about, you know, survival rates being on average into the late teens, and I think I had hope even early on that I would live beyond that, you know. And so, but to find myself here still is somewhat surprising, you know. And treatments have come a long way. Medication has come a long way. There's been a lot of advancement in those regards. And so that what used to be late teens, now average lifespan is mid-30s. And that's huge. And that's where I'm at now. Didn't think I would be alive this long, much less be married and have children. That was kind of unthinkable for me at an early age. So I feel blessed, to say the least, you know, feel very grateful and very fortunate.
You have two children, you mentioned, and a lot of people see children as part of how we live on, just future generations.
Yeah.
Do your children play a part in your wrestling with your mortality?
Absolutely, yeah. Most people that I've ever known or heard of with cystic fibrosis don't really entertain the thought of children, you know, so that I have come this far and been able to have children is, you know, a blessing beyond words for me and beyond any expectations I've ever had. To specifically answer your question, they do present a bit of a paradox for me, because raising children is so much work physically for anyone. But yeah, on, you know, 30% lung capacity, it is excruciatingly difficult physically. So it's this paradox of you know, they wear me out in a way nothing else could, but they bring life in a way nothing else could, you know, in my life. And so I often find that paradox kind of in my prayers of, you know, God, would you please help me, save me from, you know, these incredible blessings that you've bestowed on me. You know, it's really intense. And I look at them, yeah, with tiredness, but also a profound amount of hope.
Tell me about your upbringing. You come from Florissant, Missouri, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. just next door to Ferguson. We've been hearing much more about Ferguson lately than anyone probably ever had before. What was your upbringing like?
Yeah, you know, so my upbringing, you know, pastor's kid, and that had lots of great experiences, lots of dramatic components to it.
What kinds of dramatic components?
Oh, you know, stupid fights over music preferences, and so so I had kind of all that, and then growing up in school in the Ferguson Florissant School District, you know, that brought its own unique kind of flair. That was a very different life than my church world. So I go in a kind of church world, and it was a pipe organ, and then I go, you know, on the playgrounds, and it was being passed headphones with NWA or Eazy-E in them, you know. And so I loved this from earliest moments, though certainly I was not allowed to listen to Eazy-E or NWA in my church world. I resonated with both those worlds, and it wasn't, you know, till I was older that I felt a fusion between them, or to be able to talk about them both.
What resonated for you about hip-hop?
So many things. that's its own whole sermon. No, I appreciated, probably most poignantly, I appreciated this artistic share of a navigation of struggle, you know, a navigation through pain and suffering, that though it was different from my pain and suffering, you know, I had not experienced the things NWA, you know, and the like are talking about. I had my own pain of, you know, my struggle with this disease and health. And so the way artistically they navigated through that pain was extremely helpful for me.
Air Jordans appear in many of the images. In one of the pieces, there's a sneaker trying to peel away from the ground, mm-hmm. but it's stuck because of that same green goo we saw in the other piece.
Right.
It's sticking to the sole of the shoe. And then there's one of those airwave trees, the inverted lungs, mm-hmm. growing up out of the shoe. And the name of the piece is Give Me Two Pair.
Mm-hmm.
Are you talking about lungs or Air Jordans?
Both, yeah. You know, Air Jordans were coveted in my school, like probably many schools growing up in the 80s and 90s, and even to now. So I bought my first pair of Jordans because they were on sale when I was in fifth grade. I was able to get some for about $60 that were a size too small for me. But I knew that was my only chance to kind of afford them. And I put them on, and I was the envy of the school for a year to have these Jordans.
Did it hurt you wearing these tight shoes?
It did. It was miserable. But and I can't say that it really elevated my basketball play. But nevertheless, as I started to do this work, you know, dealing with my health more directly, those shoes came up because they have air in them, you know, and I need air. And I even at one point did a Google search for more air, and the first things that come up are Air Jordans and Nike Air Max and all these shoes. And so, you know, I have to do something with this. I have to incorporate this in some way because, the shoes literally have air and it speaks to that. But also, yeah, the desire for liftoff, for flight, on a practical level, because I played basketball and I wanted to jump like that too. But it spoke in terms of my, like, I wanted to fly in my life, you know, and I wanted my life to be more than what doctors were telling me it would be.
It doesn't sound like this was your intention at all, but when I looked and when I first saw the Air Jordans and next to lungs, was for someone who has cystic fibrosis, what kind of popped into my mind was just that something that most of us take for granted, which is that we have working lungs, mm-hmm. is there next to this object of desire that is so hard to get your hands on. And
mm-hmm.
It made me think about something I take for granted in a really different kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I I've not been able to take for granted breathing every breath, you know, because I feel it in every breath. And so, yeah, that's a unique challenge. That said, what that makes me aware of is all the other things I do take for granted, that I'm, you know, able to live in a house and I'm able to, you know, afford clothing and these kind of, you know, any of the number of things anybody would take for granted. The fact that I'm reminded that literally at every breath helps me go, like, what else am I taking for granted that I don't, you know, all the myriad of ways I have been blessed that I could easily forget or brush off. You know, it's not ideal to have this restriction in my breath, but it reminds me of the many, many other ways that I'm blessed, including that I do have breath at all, though it be restricted. You know, that's a blessing.
Religion has always been such a big part of your artwork. And in fact, there's an image called Ascension with a figure whose respiratory and circulatory systems are visible up against what looks like a stained glass window, kind of crisscrossed with arteries and veins. And there's also a piece called WTFITS God, which in radio safe language is "What the bleep is this bleep, God?" Nice. And it shows an Air Jordan stuck to the ground with a puddle of mucus. I mean, what is the role of religion, you know, both in your upbringing, you've kind of hinted at it, being a pastor's child and going to church a lot, but also in your life right now? I mean, yeah.
Generally, religion is trying to put some form, some, you know, around spirituality and trying to give it some community, some kind of in the flesh version. And that's hard and messy and difficult and often not fun. But to me, I've felt it very necessary. You know, I think when I first came to the Art Institute here, I was, you know, I shifted from like being around almost everybody I knew was a Christian to being around almost nobody I knew was a Christian. And I really enjoyed that transition because it was so informative for me. I was learning about things and people and cultures and ideas that I, you know, I'd heard about before, but I hadn't really experientially been involved with or knew, you know, so that was exciting to me, but I had always kind of maintained this sort of faith and this kind of belief. But when I first came here, I was like, man, I'm done with the church thing. I'm done with any organized, any of that. It was probably just a couple of years before I came to the realization like that wasn't going to be an option for me long term, you know, that I needed the community. I needed to live out my faith with other people kind of trying to do the same thing. And dive right back into the messiness of all that. So I started.
That's so interesting. Most people think of art as being this messy place and religion as being maybe more, I don't know, the opposite of that, but you've got it flipped.
Well, I mean, they're both messy, but yeah, when I think of churches, I think of some of the messiest places. That's not, if you're going in there for a bunch of, you know, clean cut, fixed people, I don't know what that is. Yeah, I saw somebody post a meme a while ago about like avoiding churches because of hypocrites or difficult people. It's like not going to the gym because of out of shape people. It's like that's where they go. They go, the out of shape people go to a church. That's the point of it.
Dylan, I'd like to hear about your role as a pastor. What made you decide to become a pastor?
All growing up, it was the one thing I never wanted to be. And you know, I would look at my father with respect and the idea of doing that and speaking in front of people and preaching sermons, there was no way. And so, you know, I went to art school and I did an internship with this church, River City, right out of art school, right out of the Art Institute. I was like, what am I, this is not for me. I need to go be an artist in New York and I need to go. So I did grad school there.
In New York.
At the School of Visual Arts. And I knew pretty much the week that I got there that I'd probably come back to work with that church again. I was, you know, simultaneously like very underwhelmed with a lot of the kind of market-driven nature I saw in New York. I love New York as a city. I love, you know, so many artists. There's obviously an incredible place. But But I had this kind of conviction to this desire to kind of come back and throw my life into this struggling little church. Yeah, so I was really interested how people would react to that. And, you know, I assumed like, oh my gosh, people are just going to slam me. What are you doing with your life and your career? And I got a couple of those, but I more got probably 58 out of 60 people was, oh, that's so awesome. I'm like, it is? You know, like you think they're like, oh yeah, that's totally cool. And even a couple of I wish I could do something like that. Like, well, you can, you know. But, you know, it was such a different transition. So, which was common to my experience in New York, there was a lot of fascination that I would believe these things, you know. And there was a lot of, I think in the Midwest, I kind of had to navigate, especially in art school, more of a like kind of anger and jadedness towards Christianity because we're in the Midwest and there's, you know, a lot of problems here that I don't need to go into.
But people like in art school might be also people who had been feeling in some way oppressed by this.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, yeah, that was not a surprise. I expected to find even more of that in New York. And what I found instead was far less of that and more of just a, you know, they didn't really have the time to bother with that. And they hadn't known really many people that believe such things. So there was this curiosity, you know, many of my professors and such would like, I'm being serious. You actually believe this? And I'm like, yeah. Like, no, I'm being for real. Like, you really, it's not performance art or anything. Like, you really, like, yes. And they'd be, oh, that's so interesting. So it was a really interesting, you know, dialogue there. But anyway, yeah, as I transitioned to going back to be a pastor, there was a, you know, yeah, kind of a respect for it, you know, that I thought was really interesting. And to any degree I can provide hope and inspiration, you know, I went just this week to pray with a family and a child that has leukemia. And I felt so bad because, you know, I came in the room and I just wept uncontrollably. I couldn't, you know, because it resonates for me that feeling of growing up a sick kid and even just kind of walking by the unit and seeing kid after kid in hospital bed was, it took me a minute to compose myself from that because it's so deep. You know, that said, there is hope that, you know, yeah, if you know, I've been fortunate to kind of make it out. I've certainly had advantages and blessings that not everyone has had, I hope I can bring, I hope that I can bring hope and life to anyone wrestling with the disease.
It sounds like, I mean, when you talk about trying to have faith and have courage, a lot of people with whatever kind of stress and anxiety they face, you know, I think most people have the desire to do that, but not necessarily the coping skills that make it possible. Is there something that you've discovered that is just, that has really worked for you?
Right. Well, a lot of days I don't have the coping mechanisms and I feel the frustration and sadness and pain. For me, my faith from early age was critical, you know, in those moments because...
religious faith.
Yeah. To kind of have a hope in a situation that, again, circumstantially, there wasn't a lot to have hope in.
Been dealing with this your whole life. I mean, in that time, what kind of changes have you seen in research and treatment?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's come a long way. They've not found a cure. They have made advancements. And really, recently in the last few years, drug development for actual treatment of the gene rather than just symptoms of it has begun. And so they've targeted different mutations of CF. The mutation that I have is the most common, you know, probably close to 50% of CF patients have this mutation. So they were really aggressive about trying to find a drug to treat this mutation. And there's kind of other drugs on the way in that regard in clinical trials, both for my mutation and for other mutations. So that's huge, you know, really huge.
Where are you with your illness right now?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, my lung function is kind of mid-30s of normal. Went, you know, much lower than this, and they start talking about putting you on a list for lung transplant. So I'm close to that. The goal, of course, is to kind of fight that off as long as you can. But that's a typical trajectory for a CF patient is to eventually get a lung transplant. and then fight with a major transplanted organ as long as you can. So each step, each year, each day is a step of faith, and it can bring a lot of anxiety, a lot of worry, a lot of stress. I battle that all the time, but try to continue to have hope, continue to have courage in the face of all that, and keep going.
So, hey, remember back at the beginning of this episode how I mentioned that Dylan was in the hospital attached to an oxygen tank? Well, early in 2017, so like a year after this conversation, his health had reached the point where he needed a transplant, and he got the call that his lungs had arrived. So he was rushed across the state and prepped for surgery. After some time in the ICU and a stint on a regular hospital floor, they removed that final chest tube and released him. Now he says he's happy he can finally spend an hour of his life without having to cough. Midwesternish is produced by Matt Hodapp and Sylvia Maria Gross. We had help on this episode from Jen Chen. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you generally do that kind of thing. These stories come from a daily show on Kansas City's public radio station, KCUR 89.3. If you want to check that out, it's called Central Standard, and you can find it at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman. Thanks for listening.